It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. You led me on a dream with no reality to try and take my pride, take my legacy. Your naked world has no respectability. I came a long way with no hospitality. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. I'm tired of hearing words, words of sympathy. Back home, your own society. I'm not waiting, my tomorrow has to come. I ain't waiting, just take a look around. Yeah. It's my life I'm fighting for.
That's one of my all-time favorites, Leon Thomas with It's My Life I'm Fighting For, released on vinyl. I'm getting feedback. released on vinyl as the A-side of his album, Full Circle. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And a very interesting program planned today, but we may not finish it today. And if we don't finish it today, we'll finish it tomorrow. As you know, this is Black History Month. I don't like the idea of having to, you know, see our existence being more pronounced in one month than another, but it's okay. It's something. When I edited a newspaper, the City Sun, history was every week. It was, in fact, known as the history paper. And we did, apart from every issue, we did special issues as well, sometimes devoting as many as 64 pages to a particular topic or an extended essay. We did all kinds of unorthodox things because, as Amos Wilson, an extraordinary thinker, an extraordinary intellect, and Dr. John Henry Clark would remind us, we should make it a habit to have history surround us every day because we are living it every single day. And we should get into the habit, as they both advise, not just listening to history, but reading it, expanding your library. I've talked about it here, the importance of expanding your knowledge base, because there's so much to correct in the historical record. There's so much to learn for the first time. There's so many ways you can do comparative analysis and get at some reasonable facsimile of the truth. And for many of us, more so than others, history, having been lost to us, is worth discovering. We've had no history, and I can tell you that as a citizen at one point, I no longer am a citizen of Trinidad, where I was born and raised. But you see how completely crazy it is now that you're grown, you know, and you're no longer owned by a colonial system. you see how warped a vision there was for you, for me, and for the millions of people coming through that colonial process. Long before I was born, it was set up so that in perpetuity, Britain, in our case, in other cases in the Caribbean, it would be France, it might even be Spain, some European power, Denmark, Norway, they literally owned you outright. And little by little, I found things to be totally incongruous with my experience, my own personal experience. And even, I would say, before I was 13 or 14, I was very angry. Because compounding the usual colonial education system was a, on top, as if that wasn't enough to deal with as a kid. You have the Catholic Church, or maybe you're an Anglican, you know, you have the Anglican Church. In my little town, we had churches for everybody. We had Hindu schools, we had Muslim schools, we had Anglicans, and we had the Catholic school. So we were well taken care of spiritually. They owned our souls outright. That's basically it. You know, their souls, our souls were just hostages. And it was all about growing up in a society where you're being groomed for your predicted place in life, which was never, ever to include leadership or achievement of any consequence. For the most part, because in my town, the main populations were Africans, Indians, including Pakistanis, and we had a smattering of Chinese. My godfather was Chinese, and there was a lot of intermarrying going on. My brother's godfather was a Lebanese Jew. My other brother, his godmother was a Hindu. And that's how we lived in this little town. It was not a pronounced separation at all among the residents of this town. We just grew up together. So coming to the United States actually was the shocker for me. I had no idea at all. I did not expect at all that there would be this, people would be living at what I considered even then as a teenager in a rather primitive way. Primitive in the sense that they seemed to have no civilized way of dealing with each other. That's when this whole thing of racism hit me like a ton of bricks. What is this system here? And everywhere I went, every part of my life brought me to this consciousness that I had better learn this new system of operating because it's very different. And it would require me to get used to these new ways of dealing with other human beings, because I could see clearly if I didn't understand it, I was not going to survive in it. And all of the propaganda about the United States was immediately shattered just on the basis of this. You say good morning to somebody, which is what we're accustomed to doing. You say good morning to your neighbor. Or if you have extra something in the, you know, you may have some extra fruit from your garden. Obviously, you will be offering your neighbor some of that. My mother would make ice cream on Sundays. You better believe. In fact, it was an 8-quart pail, and she would make about 4 or 5 of those. And the first batches of ice cream were to go to the neighbors who were Chinese on both sides of my house where we grew up. And then they, in turn, would send over some bao, which is a steamed bun, or some other delicacy. And then right across the road, we had an Indian neighbor, and she would make stuff and send it around. This is how we lived. We were all, now that we, you know, I have had the opportunity to study what my life was, we were all in the same boat, with slight variations. But the fact is, we left countries that were ravaged by colonialism and came to the small island. I didn't. I was born there. But my godfather and, you know, my in-laws via marriage to my brother, we all had to make adjustments because my forebears, my godfather and people of his generation, left wherever they left from under strict colonial rule, came to Trinidad, yet under same colonial rule. In the case of my Chinese godfather, he came to Trinidad at a time that colonial rule gave way in China to strict military rule. It's a very complicated thing. But what is fascinating is that our tiny little islands, I always used to wonder, how could people, how do you leave a place as vast as China? And you end up in this little place. Why would you do that? What would make you leave everything you know? And in my case now, with the next generation, what happened in Trinidad that my parents, from a very early age, began the process of preparing us to leave because it was inevitable? My father's mother was the last of her generation of Caribs. She was a Carib woman. But there are very few, now this is throughout the entire Caribbean, there are very, very few Caribs left. They were all wiped out. And those who had the great fortune of living very long lives found out that they didn't have too many people like them. All these things have been churning around in my head. You know, I'm being evaluated when I get to New York. I'm being evaluated so as to be placed where I belong educationally. I'm talking to this woman who was just a functionary, but at the time, you know, I assigned so much importance to this lady. I just, my whole life was resting on her determination about, you know, just where I should fit. And whatever she decided was final. So she saw that I was doing chemistry and algebra and sciences and doing quite well. And the reason in my mind that I was being evaluated was because I was supposed to start college. Now, somewhere about half an hour into our conversation, and she's talking to me and whatnot, and I'm responding, she says, do you speak English? And this, I almost fainted with disbelief. I have been talking to this woman for more than half an hour in very clear, precise, easy to understand English, which I presume she was speaking. And then it dawned on me, I am in the hand of an idiot, but an idiot with an enormous power over my life, which was 100% on her side and 0% on my side. I was too young to go to college, she said. Okay, but is that a problem? Imagine that we were talking for so long. All that time, we're having conversations, and she asked me about this, and she asked me about that, and I'm answering. And I'm thinking, okay, so far so good. We're having a good conversation. And now I'm thinking, I wonder which college or university I'm going to go next. And then she broke the news. This was not about college. You're going to Erasmus Hall High School. And you're going to be a freshman at that. It took me a long time. I instantly sank into a state of depression because I was assassinated. My future was assassinated within a half hour, and there was nothing I could do. There was a very wonderful student counselor named Mr. Rosenberg. And I went to Mr. Rosenberg almost every day in tears. I said, I'm every test, 100, 100, 100. This was terrible. I said, Mr. Rosenberg, I have to be a senior and I have to get out of here very, very soon. He says, well, this is where they graded you and this is where you ought to be. And try to just do your best and let's see if we could speed up the process. But that was the concession. The concession was I was already destroyed. I ended up, of course, being moved out of freshman class. And then I learned so much. I learned really how this country operates. It's crazy. If you have the grades, you should be able to go ahead with your life. But not so. But because of that experience, when my two younger brothers came, I was able to fend them off. Or fend the process off. They didn't have to go through what I went through. And it was terrible. It was a really awful feeling. Years later, the Alumni Association, the president of the association invited me to go to Erasmus and give a talk. It was to be a parents' night. And it was very, very well attended. He and I went, of course, obviously, to the same school. He, too, was from Trinidad. And I looked out at this auditorium, crammed to the rafters. But it did not look anything like I remembered the population of the school looking when I went there. It was all black. Not a single white face in the auditorium. And they were clearly Caribbean predominantly Caribbean. So I'm on the stage looking out at the audience. The auditorium is filled, and their students and their parents, an extraordinarily high representation of parents. And it kind of cheered me up, because in my day, that was not what I would have seen. And I thought, well, you know, you start off a little talk, you ask some questions, and you get things going, you know, participation by the audience. And I said, well, how many teachers here tonight know that they are teaching children who someday will be great leaders and will have achieved a great deal? Now, I'm expecting hands to just pierce the sky. Not one hand went up. I thought, well, maybe they didn't hear me. So I repeated the question, and I got the same reaction. Not one single hand, not one teacher raised his or her hand to affirm that they believed that one child, I was going to settle for one. And that set me off. I went off. So I asked the parents to please stand up and look around. Tell me what you see. I said, I asked, from my view, a rhetorical kind of question, just to break the ice. But the response was that not one teacher, not one, felt that they had even one child in their class who was going to do something great in life. I went off. And I started instructing the parents. I didn't even care about the principal and all the dignitaries anymore. I said, this is what you bring your children to every day. A slow, calculated death. It is shameful. And now you know you have to do some thinking to salvage your children, to save them from a system bent on killing them. You're working all day. Perhaps you're a nurse or a cab driver, but you're working because in your head, what you left behind should be not nearly as glorious as what you brought them to. This is why you sacrifice every day. But the system believes that while you're doing your job to pay your rent and, you know, put food on the table and keep your kids looking clean and neat, not one teacher in this school believes your child is worth the effort just to do your job. And that was the breaking point for me in understanding racism. The damage it does, how it selects its targets, and why they select their targets, how predatory it is, and how, in one way or the other, we are all shaped by this. No tags, you know. There's no tag that you wear that says, "Yes, I'm a racist, so you would want to avoid me." No, we're just living in a society. We're just living in a society. I wanted to share a clip with you, but I think we'll do that tomorrow. Because I want to give you a sense of my own experience. So that the terror I left in Trinidad, which didn't look like terror, didn't feel like terror, was exactly the same terror I experienced in New York. It didn't look like it. It didn't feel like it. But I was on my way to being completely dumbed down. The possibilities of me being able to achieve anything would have been totally obliterated had I not caught myself and taken cues from this society. It was no different, in other words. So then I asked myself, is it a different locale, a different system? And one would expect that the system I left, which by comparison was, way below grade even. I mean, when I started school, I didn't have a school book. And that I didn't think that that was poverty. I had, if I was lucky, I'll have a whole slate to write on. Or I would have a big enough piece of slate to write on. And then all the children will go up in, we used to call it the skatey hill. It was just a hill that became very slippery when it rained. And that's where we got our chalk. You go up the hill and you dig up a little piece of limestone. And that's how you learn to write, with a broken piece of slate and some chalk that you just dug up yourself. Really organic approach, wouldn't you say? Very organic. But here's the thing. I was literate by the age of two. I don't say this boastfully because I was not the only one. Mrs. Waterman, Mrs. King, you get to learn how to read. They bring you up and put you in their laps, and they put their hand over your hand, and they course the letters, and you repeat the motion of their hand, and that's how we learn to read. You're not sitting home saying mama dada. You are reading. But you're reading what the colonial powers want you to read. What's nonsensical. As in fact, my good friend the Mighty Sparrow has a calypso about that. Dan is the man in the van. That's what they were teaching us to read. Dan is the man in the van. Twisty and twirly were two screws. That's what the British considered a competent curriculum for a child who had the capacity to be far along at a much higher grade than that. But that's what we got. Because the British, some guy in London, is correcting your papers to see if you could get a shot, if you deserve a shot to go to high school. We're learning about our culture via the BBC World Service. some rediffusion. That's our knowledge, is coming from London about ourselves. When I was in high school, we had it was an all-girls school, and everybody was required to learn cookery, as they called it, by the Irish nuns. And we are assigned not to make callaloo, not to make sweetbread, the things that we would eat at home, but steak and kidney pie, shepherd's pie, and such. Everything we were taught to make was completely foreign to our cuisine. So what I'm saying is that this occurred to me after a while, that it was so incongruous with my own ideas about where I ought to be and what it is I want to do. It was so alien to me. I was an alien in my own country, because that's how the power structure wanted it, so that they could predict precisely when I would come of an age where I should be integrated into their system, which I will operate for them by proxy. And that's what colonialism is. That's what imperialism is. A slow ride to your intellectual death. Imagine that. It's genocidal. And that's why most people, early in life, it's not about them. They don't care about themselves after a certain time. Their whole life is poured into their children, because they know they will have to get out for the simple reason of survival. You have no choice in that matter. You make no decision in that regard. You're a child, and your parents know within themselves what has to be done to save your life. In my household, for example, and people were considered quite well-to-do. My father owned several businesses. My mother owned her own. All of my friends, and they were Chinese and Indian and black, their parents did a version of what my parents did. In my household, I remember when I was 7, I got 2 things. That's how we celebrated your 7th birthday. It wasn't about the cake and all of that stuff. We didn't do parties. But on your 7th birthday, you will get 2 things. You will get a bank book, and you will get a passport. You were expected. That bank book should grow. Whatever little money you have, you make a big deal of it and you save it up until you get at least $1 to go down to the bank and put your dollar. And you get a passport. In fact, on my very first passport, they asked profession, and I was listed as child. I was a child, a professional child. But what I'm saying is that this was a recognition. They didn't just say it to me, but this was in preparation as many other families began to prepare their children to leave home. What kind of society does that and thinks that way? Well, the kind of society that does that and thinks that way is a society that has understood or has come to understand what colonialism will force you to do, so you might as well be ahead of the curve. Now, all of this is a long-winded way of coming to the point of planning to survive. And it includes being ready to defend yourself, because that's what you'll have to do. And it's not just for children, it's for the adults. They have to learn enough about a system in order to prepare their children for what's coming at them. And this is my constant message about gathering as much information as you possibly can about how systems work, how they operate, so that you are not alarmed by what you see and what you hear. You understand it's simply a matter of the system doing its thing. The people in the system may not even be aware. You probably would be thinking at a much deeper level than the average person involved in the system. But you must understand the system, because absolutely there is one. Here in the United States, the system is race-based. There's no denying that. It is class-based. No denying that. But it is also populated and operated by people who are required to be out of their minds. They have to take a leave of their senses to do the things that they do for a paycheck. No teacher that I encountered was malicious toward me. I mean, as a rule, get one or two who are just crazy, but you recognize that. Even as a child, you recognize, you know, some people are not wrapped too tight. But it is their job, because they have to earn a salary. The deal is, you carry out this program or this portion of the program, and you get a paycheck. And then you retire, and then, you know, you go wherever it is you want to go, and then you die. But it doesn't mean that we have to be crazy. It means that we have to outsmart the system. All the time, you have to be thinking, what is it likely to do next? If you understand the system, Donald Trump is no surprise to you, or will be no surprise to you. We've talked about, in fact, just today, I saw an article about members of Congress, including some Republicans, are sounding the alarm that they think Donald Trump has mental problems. How long have we been talking about that? Imagine it took them this long to figure that out. But he is precisely the kind of person that the people who are locked into the system, who will not dislodge themselves from it, because their lives, in one way or the other, require them to be attached to the system of power, system of making a livelihood. So if Donald Trump were to run down Madison Avenue completely naked, people would just, it's just Donald. He's just a wacky kind of guy. No, it's possible that he's stark, raving crazy. But the system would not permit people who see it to do anything about it, not even to voice their concerns about it. So I saw yesterday this article saying that Democrats, many Democrats, and increasingly members of the Republican Party, the rumblings are increasing about the concern of Donald Trump's mental health. Well, let me get back to my little lecture today, which is about understanding systems and understanding that no matter what you're doing or intend to do for a living, where you live, I lived in a colonial system, you'd be crazy not to begin to fashion a system that allows you to survive. That's the first order of business. And then, to the best of your ability, create a system that not only allows you to survive, that reinforces your capacity to survive with the standards that you have. They're surviving and they're surviving. I can't tell you how many times since, especially when I lived in New York, I got a lot of offers. Come work for this media company. Come work for that media. Come work for this newspaper. Come work. And I had no interest in any of that. I loved what I did. I started it. I had no experience at all. And this is not about being bright and being brilliant. No, no, no. It's just having a conviction about what it is you want to do. It's not about money or fame. It's about setting for yourself standards that you can live with. To the best of your ability, you establish high standards that will always keep you moving to get better and better at what you want to do without feeling compromised and shamed, actually, shaming yourself for falling way beneath the standards you set for yourself. And that was an extraordinary gift I got from my own father. My mother, too, in her own way. But on Saturday nights in our household, it was not funny to be a household. Because my father's taking care of business. We're all gathered there in the living room, and he calls everybody to account for the entire week. My mother was the daily dispenser of justice. My father held what he called constitutional talks, We weren't allowed to talk, and it was never about the Constitution. We were just there to listen and answer when asked a question. But it was really about setting a discipline and encouraging us in that way to develop a very strong sense of self. Why? Because the society will break you down. And in the end, we have to live with the idea that we are our own best friends. We are absolutely the only one you could absolutely depend on. So if you have only you to totally depend on, and you're weak, then you're done. Because when you leave your home in Trinidad, and you find yourself, as my oldest brother did, in London and then in Germany, or as my second brother did, also in New York, or my sister in Wisconsin, or my two older brothers to study medicine and to get into the field of computers all the way back then, or my brother right before me to go to Howard University. He actually had won a complete scholarship to Columbia University. And I remembered him coming home and announcing he had just quit because he wasn't learning anything there. Almost made my mother faint to the floor. But he went to Howard, and we would get mail from him and phone calls from him. What a fantastic decision that was, he would say. Because he's learning and he's enjoying everything. He has to buy his own lab equipment, his own medical supplies, but he was happy. Well, he did very, very well. My two younger brothers, the same. So the idea is preparing yourself with the knowledge of how the world works. Preparing your children, but mostly preparing yourself with the knowledge of how this world works. In the United States, how this world works, and countries like the United States, how they are likely to work, even if you're not there. And it's not just about blind ambition and you do things because you can make a lot of money and, you know, really, that's not the way you want to do it. You do it because it is part of making you strong to face the world and to survive in it and help those around you who could use that kind of help. Because in the end, that is what gives us the awesome privilege of being alive today, when you think about it. Our forebears learned how the world works. And they passed this information down, so that people today don't have to go through the same craziness that they did. And when you are a member of an oppressed class, especially, which I consider myself to be, this is one of the greatest gifts you can have, that you understand reasonably well. It doesn't have to be perfect, but you do have to make the effort to consciously engage in that exercise of understanding the way the world works. Hence, some people call it history, or some people think it's enough to just wait and hear from somebody how the world works. But scholars have said in the books that I've read and the people I knew personally and in the way I was raised, you better go find out. We do not know everything about how the world works. But to the extent that we can unravel some of those things for you that could cause you extraordinary amounts of pain, we'll tell you those things that we know. But there's a lot more to know than we know. And we can't give you that. You have to now exercise your part of the responsibility of making it important in your life to go and read and acquire this information so that you know. And that would lessen your pain. It would lessen the travails that you will encounter in life. It will make you stronger, and it will equip you to better serve the purpose you think you are here to serve. So that was what I wanted to talk about, really, in a much more condensed form. I violated all the rules today, but it was on my mind, because in the end, Black History Month, or any kind of history month, and this is why I naturally gravitated toward history with the newspaper. And then part of the process of researching it was doing a small poll in the New York City area. And when we asked people, what would you like to see in a Black newspaper that you don't see now? And by the way, many, many of our subscribers were white. The first check we received as subscribers were Pete Seeger and Toshi Seeger. And wherever they went, they made sure that we sent the paper to wherever they traveled to. They didn't miss an issue. But when we got the results of the poll, what did people say was the first thing, the most important thing to them? It was history. It was history. It was the thing that keeps us going, the thing that helps us form a strong identity, a sense of place in this world, and the courage to continue. It gives us a very strong set of roots that no matter what comes your way, you may not win, but you put up a good fight. But you are fighting with the intelligence of who you are. And nobody can give you that. We've had the good fortune of having scholars devote their entire lives to this kind of work. And it's not just about recording an event for posterity, or to say, here, it's written down. History, in the end, is about helping us, people who are oppressed, helping us come to terms fully with who we are, what we can do, and our capacity to survive. So I want to thank you so much for letting me ramble on a little bit, but we will get the second half done tomorrow. I promise. I beg your indulgence for today. But it is related, and in a sense, it's the second part to what it is we're talking about today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program. Until then, a pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. It's my life.